So let's read verses 22 to 24 in chapter 14. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor on earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, for fear you would say, I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me, his allies, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their share. Now notice what's happening here. The king of Sodom wanted to pay Abram. You know, he was saved along with the other people that were saved by Abram. Abram's primary goal was to save Lot, who had been living in Sodom. But the king of Sodom got included in his deliverance. And he wanted to pay Abram a reward or some tribute. And Abram refused to receive it. And on page 63 of your notes, at the bottom, it says, Abram swore before the Lord, God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, that he would take nothing that belonged to Sodom, lest the king take credit for making Abram rich. Now, what's really behind this is this. God had promised to bless Abraham, well, Abram at this point, to give him all the land he could see, to make a great nation out of him, and so forth. So for him to accept anything from the king of Sodom would show a mistrust of God's promises. Well, see, he had been promised all these things already. It's similar to, remember when Sarah died and he wanted to buy a piece of land with a cave on it to bury Sarah? And the owner of that piece of land offered it to him for free, and he said, no, I want to pay what is fair for it. He didn't want to receive anything from man because that would diminish his faith in what God had promised him. In other words, the man who benevolently offered Abraham that parcel of ground was giving Abraham something God had already promised him, and he didn't want to do that. Bera, Sodom's king, offered a most appealing deal. But Abram, knowing what he did about the king of Sodom, and we all know what kind of people these were, felt that keeping Sodom's loot, which he captured, would make him subject to Bera. Now that's another problem. How would it be viewed? Would it be viewed as a reward, or would it be viewed as tribute? Because if it's tribute, then Abram becomes obligated to protect the king of Sodom. And Abram didn't want any tribute from the king of Sodom. He didn't want to be attached to him in any way. Abram wanted something far more enduring than possessions and wealth. He wanted the fulfillment of God's miraculous and enduring promises, which contained everything and more than the king of Sodom was offering him. Abram knew that he would become more prosperous, and he knew who was blessing him. He intended to receive everything from God and not even a thread from Sodom. He wanted his faith to be in God. And that's, if you think about it, that's not a small thing. I mean, suppose God showed you through some convincing way that he was going to prosper you. And then someone of questionable moral standing offered you something of value. That might not be a good idea. It might not be a good idea to take that. First of all, because you're attaching yourself to someone who's involved in immorality. And second of all, why do you take what God has already promised you? Where is your faith in God? Okay, 18. The king of Sodom was obviously a wicked man over a wicked empire. Abram discerned that dealing with him might be dangerous, which it was. Abram could have reasoned that God was seeking to bless him by means of this offer. However, he could not bring himself to equate the blessing of God with the best that Sodom had to offer. Now, that's the opposite. Do you remember when we were studying a messianic prophecy, and we were studying Isaiah 7 and 14, and Ahaz was the king of Israel, and Assyria was trying to conquer all these different nations, and Judah, the king of Assyria was conquering different nations, was gobbling them up. And Israel and Aram made an alliance with one another to go against Assyria. They weren't strong enough, so they went to Ahaz and said, let's the three of us get together and go against Assyria. And Ahaz refused because Ahaz was paying tribute to Assyria, so Assyria would protect it. And so he was not trusting in the Lord at all for deliverance. He was trusting in Assyria, his enemy. So that's exactly the opposite of Abraham's position. Abraham could have, I mean, if he had accepted what the king of Sodom offered him, it was probably a lot of money plus people. And Abraham's trust in God was greater. He knew that what God had promised him and his descendants was greater than anything man could give him. Okay, now 19, Melchizedek is an important figure in the Bible. He's only mentioned somewhat briefly in Genesis, and it's often questioned, was Melchizedek just a man, or was Melchizedek a pre-incarnate appearance of the Messiah? I see no reason to say he was a pre-incarnate appearance of the Messiah. There's nothing in there in the text to indicate that. Better, it's an argument from silence. That's what it is. And you don't want to argue from a position of silence. So I believe he was a man, but a very important man. Preceding Abram, he was not a Levitical priest. You see that? He couldn't be a Levitical priest, because Levi hadn't even been born yet. When David, the first Israelite king to sit on Melchizedek's throne, prophesied that his great descendant, the Messiah, would be a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, that's in Psalm 110:4, David looked beyond the Levitical priesthood, which would be done away with. You see, the Mosaic law was all founded on the Levitical priesthood. You can't detach one from the other. The Mosaic law revolved around the Levitical priesthood, and the Levitical priesthood was founded upon the Mosaic law. So if there's a change in the priesthood, which there would be because Melchizedek was not a Levitical priest, clearly, Levi hadn't even been born yet, that means there has to be a change in the law. There has to be a new law, and it can't be a Levitical priesthood, but this law has to be a priest, have priests after the order of Melchizedek, which is pretty important because that's evidence that the Mosaic law, from Abraham's perspective, would be, and from our perspective, has been done away with. And we're under a new law, with a new priesthood. Preceding Aram, he was not a Levitical priest. When David, the first Israelite to sit on Melchizedek's throne, The book of Hebrews demonstrates how Messiah in his death fulfilled the Levitical order and began a better high priesthood. See, the Levitical priests, what would they do? They would sacrifice animals yearly. Once a year they had Yom Kippur, and they would sacrifice, they'd have a blood sacrifice to cover the sins of the people for that 1 year. But with the death of the Messiah, the Levitical priesthood was done away with, wasn't it? The temple was destroyed in AD 70. But His death fulfilled the Levitical order and began a much better high priesthood because we no longer have to perform blood sacrifices. He died once for all. And his blood is sufficient to cover all sins forever. So Messiah is a priest after the order of Melchizedek, not after the order of Levi. So there's a change. In referring to Melchizedek as the perfect type of Messiah, does everybody know what a type is? Let's just make sure we all know what a type is. A type is something in the Old Testament, something in the Old Testament that foreshadows something in the New Testament. And so Melchizedek was a type of Messiah. In other words, there are things about Melchizedek that you can also say about Messiah, and so many things that he becomes a type. And the way it works is Melchizedek is called the type, and Messiah would be called the anti-type, who fulfills the type. So, for example, the writer of Hebrews capitalized on Melchizedek's anonymity, whereas Genesis is filled with genealogies and ancestral notation, this man appears without family records. Melchizedek is remembered as a high priest. And when you look at Melchizedek, metaphorically speaking, he has no lineage, he has no genealogy, without mother, without father. Now, we're not saying he literally didn't have a mother and father, but unlike all of the other people spoken of up to this point in Genesis, his lineage is not recorded at all. He comes on the scene, we don't know from where, does what he does. We're told that he's a high priest, and he's also a king, which Messiah was both of them. And then he disappears from the scene. So he was a perfect type of Messiah. Whereas Genesis is filled with genealogies and ancestral notation, this man appeared without family records. Melchizedek is remembered as a high priest. Now, here's something that often causes a little bit of trouble. Because Abram paid tithes to Melchizedek, the order of Melchizedek is superior to Levi, who descended from Abram. We're taught that in the book of Hebrews, and let me explain exactly what that means. There's a basic rule of thumb, the lesser tithes to the greater. So we can say that Melchizedek was greater than Abram, because Abram tithed to Melchizedek, right? However, what the author of the Hebrews says is Levi tithed to Melchizedek because he was in the loins of Abram when Abram tithed. So this concept of him being in Abram is similar to our being in Adam when he bit the fruit of the tree. And so Levi paid tithes to Melchizedek in Abraham's loins. Now, here's a way to look at that that helps to make some sense. Einstein once said something very profound. God invented time so everything wouldn't happen all at once. It's kind of humorous, but it's true. Time prevents everything from happening all at once. But from God's point of view, since he supersedes time, he sees everything at once. And so, from God's point of view, Levi did tithe to Melchizedek. It's just time that separates Levi from Melchizedek, but God is not bound by time. And in the same way, we fell with Adam. We were in the loins of Adam. Because if you collapse time into one instant, that's where we were when Adam fell. So Levi clearly was the lesser, and Melchizedek was the greater. It's a greater priesthood. Okay, any questions so far? Does that kind of make sense? There's areas of that that are a little bit shadowy to us, we have to admit, because it's not something that we're used to thinking about every day. But I was in the loins of my father before I was born, because God saw me. And if you collapse that all the way back, I was in the loins of Adam, as was my father and as was my child. It's time that separates all of this, but again, time, God supersedes time. Okay, moving on to chapter 15. Abram's dilemma, verses 1 to 3. After these things, that's after the battles that Abram was involved in and the saving Lot from the kings and from slavery. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." Abram said, "O Lord God, what will you give me, since I am childless and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" Eliezer was the son of Sarah's maid. And that's the only other male living in the house. So, well, we'll get to it in the notes, but if a man's wife took on a servant, she could give that servant to her husband as a wife. And in that culture, she would be recognized as his wife, and Eliezer would be recognized as the heir. But Abram, that was not acceptable to Abram, because he wanted the heir to come from his own loins. So Abram said, "Since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir, Eliezer." So Abram's dilemma. Abraham's refusal to receive a blessing from Bera, king of Sodom, indicated that he was still trusting God alone to bless him. His faith was also affirmed by how he addressed God, Adonai. Now, I'm going to pronounce it, but the second word there, which is transliterated Jehovah, is that unpronounceable name of God, according to the Jewish people. But it translates Lord God. God is an expression of his mightiness and his omnipotence. Lord is an expression of his sovereignty over all creation. Okay, so he's sovereign and he's also the Almighty. Notice he's only called God in the creation story. But once man is created, he's then also referred to as sovereign, because in order to be sovereign, there's some group of people over which you have to be sovereign. Okay. His faith was also, by how we address God, Adonai Yehovah. The first name means master. The second, covenant keeper. That's two expressions that go along with that. His master, sovereignty, and his covenant keeper, the Almighty. However, when God appeared to Abram in a vision and told him that his reward would be great, Abram became worried. He was old and childless, so he's concerned that his household servant, Eliezer, would be his heir rather than a son of his own blood. The social texts from Nuzi in northern Mesopotamia demonstrate that it was common for a childless couple to adopt a servant as an heir. This is somewhat like our surrogacy today. You know how sometimes you have a woman who's a surrogate? This is very similar to that. A servant who has a child can be adopted by the master and his wife and becomes legally the child. Okay, verses 4 to 6. Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, to Abram, saying, "This man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body shall be your heir." How old was Abraham? 99. And he took him outside and said, "Look now towards the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." Can you imagine what Abraham must have seen? I mean, think about it. When you go outside on a clear night and look up, you can't count the stars. But what we see isn't even close to how many stars were in Abraham's sight, because number one, there was absolutely no pollution at that point, no smog. And number two, one of the problems that they have with observatories is if there's a city nearby, the light from that city becomes something that blocks out a lot of light coming down from the heavens into the telescope. When Abraham looked up at the sky, it must have just been filled with stars, many times more stars than we see. And here we see God saying to Abraham, "Now look toward the heaven and count the stars, if you are able to count them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." Now this is what we call hyperbole. It's exaggeration for the sake of emphasis. Because there's billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of stars. And he's not saying to Abraham, there's going to be exactly as many heirs of yours as there are stars. It's a hyperbole just to say there's going to be a tremendous amount of offspring that come from your loins. Okay? And here's one of the most important verses in the Bible. 6. Then he believed in the Lord, and he, the Lord, reckoned it to him as righteousness. This is an extraordinarily important verse. First of all, notice that Abraham was not justified by works. He was justified by grace through faith. And the righteousness was reckoned to him. He didn't earn it. And that word reckoned, you know what it's like? Suppose you have a bank account. Okay? This is I'll show you like by little graphic. Suppose you have a bank account. And here's a ledger where your account is, right? And let's say this is minus and this is plus, okay? But what this measures is, if we measured money, every time you'd make a deposit, you'd put money there. And every time you made a withdrawal, you'd put money there, and you could strike a balance at any time. So let's suppose before becoming a believer, there's zero here, right? No righteousness. And there's, just put a big number there. There's a million here. You owe a debt to God. When God reckons righteousness to you, it's a legal term, meaning that he reckons to you the righteousness of Messiah, which is without end. So when we strike a balance here, you're reckoned to be righteous. And notice, it has nothing to do with works. Okay? Abraham is justified by faith. Verses 4 to 6. The Lord answered, "This man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir." God then showed Abram the stars and stated that Abram's descendants would be just as numerous. And again, that's an hyperbole. The word by which God created the stars would also guarantee Abram's seed. That's very interesting. God is speaking to Abraham And he's the same God who spoke the stars into existence. So Abraham could look up at the stars and know he who made the stars by merely speaking them into existence is speaking to me a promise. That's how sure. That's why God chose the stars. Because from time immemorial, from the days of Adam, people knew where the stars came from the Word of God. The Lord answered, this man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. Oh, I'm down here, B. The word by what, I'm C. Abraham believed, and literally it's believed in, saving faith. It's not merely that Abraham believed the God about this one item. He believed that it was a relationship that was developed. Abram believed, literally believed in the Lord, and he, God, credited him as righteousness. This foundational truth is repeated three times in the New Testament, the Brit Chadashah, in Romans, Galatians, and James. It indicates that righteousness comes not from human works, but through faith in God. So, Abraham, being justified by faith, affirms the New Testament teaching on faith versus works. It's way back, you go way back to the days of Abraham, and it was faith that saves. Well, grace saves through faith and not works. And so Genesis 15 affirms the New Covenant teaching on salvation by grace through faith. The Abrahamic covenant did not give Adam redemption. The Abrahamic covenant was a covenant between Abraham and Abraham's descendants who were in his loin, but that was not the redeeming covenant. That was a special covenant between Abraham and his descendants and God that had specific provisions. The Abrahamic covenant did not give Abram redemption. It was a covenant God made with Abram who had already believed and to whom righteousness had already been imputed. We're not up to the Abrahamic covenant yet. That's going to come in a little while. The Bible clearly teaches that in all ages, imputed righteousness, and if you want to substitute, you could say salvation, comes by faith in all times. So when we study the Bible and we study a period of time, people are under the law, let's see. They lived under the law and we didn't. But they were still saved the same way we are, by grace through faith. Now, faith in what? What is it that we have faith in that saves us? God is always the object of our faith. So our faith is directed in the same direction as Abram's was, towards God. We have faith in God. Now, the revelation that God has given at any point in human history may vary, but it's by believing in that revelation that you demonstrate your belief in the true and living God. Clearly, Abraham did not know about things like crucifixion. We have more revelation given to us than Abraham did. But he believed in the same God as we do. He believed in a resurrection and so forth. Okay. Now, the covenant ratified, and you've seen this before. I've done this for you. So I'm just going to read through this and see if you remember this. See if you remember this, and then if you have any questions, let me know. But let me read verses 7 to 21 first. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. He said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? How can I be certain of this? So he said to him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat and a 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Remember this? This is the ratification of the covenant. This is similar to us signing a contract. Then he brought all these to him and cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. Is everybody following this so far? Do you remember this? That when two men entered into a contract, they would make this trench, put animals on each side that were cut in half, and blood would fill the trench, and they would walk through the trench together. And each one would say, may God do so and more to me if I do not keep my obligations under the covenant. Okay, that's what's happening. And who do you think the birds of prey are? The birds of prey are Egypt. Egypt tried to foil the Abrahamic covenant, but Abraham drove them away. Now, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. Now, that deep sleep that fell upon Abram, God put him to sleep. And the sleep that he experienced, the Hebrew is the same Hebrew as the sleep that Adam experienced. It was an extraordinarily deep sleep. Remember when God put Adam to sleep to remove one of his ribs? Now we're going to do a demonstration. Here you, lie on a table on your back. I'm going to remove one of your ribs with my pen. Okay. If you go to sleep, you won't feel a thing. Oh, you're very nice. Okay, anyway. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs. What's that? Egypt. Where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And that's just what happened. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. And we'll explain what that means in just a moment. It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. What does that represent? God. God's going through those, just like in ratifying a covenant. Where was Abraham when this was taking place? He was sleeping. That demonstrates to us that the Abrahamic covenant is unilateral. In other words, it does not depend on obedience or faithfulness upon Abraham. Not that Abraham shouldn't be faithful and obedient, nor on his descendants, but the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant depends solely on the faithfulness of God. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. The Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite, all pagan societies. Okay, now let's go to the notes. And I'm just going to read through them because we've done this before. But if you have a question, let me know. In Abram's day, a covenant, we would call it a contract today, was not ratified. That means was not made legal. Let me see something. I'll tell you what. We're going to start with this because I don't want to chop this up. So, because it is time for our break. So we're going to take our break now and then we'll do this section when we come back from our break because I don't want to chop it in half. In the notebook on page 66, in Abram's day, a covenant or contract was not ratified by the parties of the covenant signing a document as it is in our day. Rather, the parties to the contract would dig a long trench tear a number of small animals in half and put the halves along the sides of the trench. As the blood from the animals flowed into the trench, the parties to the covenant would walk through the trench together and say, "May God do so and more to me if I do not keep my obligations under this covenant." And that would seal or ratify the covenant. God instructed Abram to construct such a trench. Then, when the sun was going down, God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Abram. While Abram was sleeping, God told him about the 400-year enslavement of his descendants, after which they would return to the land promised to Abram. The enslavement was symbolized by birds of prey swooping down on the trench to get at the pieces of the animals Abram had prepared. Egypt, like the birds of prey, opposed the covenant. However, the promise would ultimately be fulfilled. Abram's descendants would be freed and returned to the promised land. Exodus 20:40 and Galatians 3:17 state that the Egyptian bondage was 430 years. Apparently, Genesis 5:13 and Acts 7, which describe the bondage as being 400 years, or using rounded figures. Now, someone might come along and say, "Hi, there's an error in the scriptures." But let me show you what's being done there so we can see that there's no error in the scriptures. Because there are those who say, "Hey, it says 430 here, and it only says 400 here," and they claim there's an error. There are two concepts in mathematics that you learn when you study mathematics. One is called accuracy. And the other is called precision. I'm not even sure I'm spelling that right. Yeah, precision. Now, here's the difference. Everybody familiar with that thing you do in high school, pi?
And,
well, now watch. Pi is a number. It's 3 point, and then the numbers never end. It just keeps going. You can keep doing it forever. It never comes to a conclusion. Now, pi is 3.1. But there's numbers after the 1, too. There's numbers that go on forever. Next number is 3.14. Now, let me ask you a question. Is this accurate? Yes. Pi is 3.1. This is accurate. And to a higher degree of precision. That's all. In the Bible, for example, there's a well. I forget where it is, but it's 1 foot in diameter. That's it. And then it's mentioned that it's 3 feet in circumference. So people would come along and say, "That's really not accurate, because pi is 3.14, blah, blah, blah." But how accurate do you have to be when you're digging a well? It's not like you're doing surgery and doing a knee replacement where this number has to be extremely precise. See what I'm saying? So in the scriptures, they're just doing what we do today. You should always be accurate. But the degree of precision you're going to have depends upon what you're going to use the number for. And if I have a well that's exactly 1 foot in diameter, and you say, what's the circumference? That's the measurement around. I say, three feet. Is it necessary for me to get out a calculator and do pi to the 20th place? It's just not necessary. But if a doctor is going to go to a particular area of the brain and has to get exactly to that area of the brain, he might, and he needs pi in his calculation, he might want to take pi out to 5 or 6 places. It's more precise, but not more accurate. Everybody follow that? Okay. So, where was I here? 6. God is just and wished to permit the sins of the Amorites to be full before he would judge them. That's the people living on the land right now. And that's why God didn't have Abram go immediately to the land and conquer it. God would tolerate their sins until Israel, under Joshua, conquered Canaan. Thus, the fulfillment of the promises to Abraham involves a retributive judgment on the inhabitants of the land of Canaan. Now, when it says the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full, that's an expression of one of the attributes of God called forbearance. God's forbearance is his long-suffering patience with regard to sin. He doesn't crush someone because they sin or live a sinful life immediately. He's very patient. He was extraordinarily patient with these pagan societies. Centuries he gave them. But God's forbearance does have an end. And here it says that it would have an end. It would be full. The iniquity of the Amorites would be full. And that's when Joshua went in and destroyed them all. After sunset, God revealed himself in the image of a smoking oven and a flaming torch. These passed through the trench while Abraham slept. Notice, Abraham is a party to this covenant, but has no obligations under the covenant. These elements were connected with sacrificial ritual in the ancient world, and they represent, in this particular concept, God. Because only God, that is, the oven and the torch, and not Abraham, passed through the trench, the Abrahamic covenant is unilateral. Now, that word unilateral, you're familiar with the... See, there's two kinds of covenants, unilateral and bilateral. Everybody know what a unicycle is? You see them in the circus? This is like a cycle with one wheel. Unilateral, one person size. A bicycle is a two-wheeled instrument. A bilateral covenant involves each person having an obligation. Okay. God even specified the geographical boundaries of Israel's land from the river of Egypt, and that's the river Wadi El Arish, not the Nile River, to the great river, the Euphrates. So if you want to look that up on a map, don't look for the Nile River. It's the Wadi El Arish. Israel has never possessed this land in its entirety, but she will when Yeshua returns to reign as Messiah. For Abram, God's message was clear. In spite of the prospects of his own death and suffering from his descendants, enslavement and bondage, his descendants would receive the promises, for God had assured it. Now, you can imagine the Jewish people who've just come out of Egypt reading this, written by Moses. The original readers would be quite uplifted by something like this. Remember who it's written to. Okay, so... Israel could also be encouraged while in bondage in Egypt. As well as in subsequent times of distress, even during the Babylonian captivity. If you were a Jewish person who had a personal relationship with God in the Babylonian captivity, you could know that God ultimately would bring the Jewish people back to the land of promise. And it even affirms that in the book of Jeremiah. God's solemn covenant assures the chosen people of the ultimate fulfillment of his promises in spite of their death and suffering. God is faithful. Israel would also notice the parallel between the beginning of this narrative, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur," with Exodus 29:2, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt." So they would make the link there. God brought Abram out of Ur and made some promises to them. God brought Israel out of Egypt, and the promises made to Abraham apply to his descendants. This assured Israel that in spite of opposition and bondage, God would judge their enslavers and fulfill his promise. This passage also encourages believers today. God affirms solemnly that he will fulfill his promises concerning salvation and all the blessings that pertain to that life. Despite opposition, suffering, and even death, God keeps his promises. Now look at John chapter 14. I'll give you an example of where this principle holds. We all go through difficult times, and sometimes it seems like God isn't there, although he is. But in John chapter 14, starting from verse 1, listen what it says. Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. Now watch this. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Now there's the Messiah, who is God, making a promise to the disciples and through them to us. So we as believers can know them, no matter falling on hard times, illness, anything, this will come to pass because God is faithful. And if we ever doubt, all we have to do is read the story of Abraham and the land and Israel, and even think today, who possesses the land today? Well, Israel, although there's some who don't want Israel there. But the nation of Israel is once again in existence after thousands of years of it not being in existence. God is getting the land of Israel and the Jewish people. He's in the early stages of getting them ready for his return. We are in the last days. For Abram, God's message was clear. No, I read that. Read all of that. All right, chapter 16. Sarah and Hagar. Sarah was Abraham's wife. Hagar was Sarah's servant. And we want to start on chapter 17. I'm sorry, chapter 16. And we want to start with verses 1 to 6 in the Bible. Now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abram, "Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go in to my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai, and that would be a surrogacy, as we would look at it today. After Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife. He doesn't have enough aggravation. He went in to Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. She looked down at her mistress. I conceived and you can't. And Sarai said to Abram, here's a typical female response, "May the wrong done me be upon you." And Abram's probably sitting there, "Well, I do." It means nothing. Anyone who's a husband knows that Abraham's in a spot. "May the wrong done me be upon you. I gave you my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me." And she was basically saying, "You're responsible for this family, so it's your fault." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight." So Sarai treated her harshly, and she fled from her presence. So Hagar runs away. Well, Sarai is treating her very harshly. She runs away. Okay? Let's go to the notes. Sarai and Hagar. Sarai was old and barren, so by all human standards, the heir of the promise could not come through her. This set in motion some unwise activities on the part of Abram and Sarai. Abram would learn, however, that the promise was to be fulfilled in God's ways, not in Abram's way. In the legal custom of that day, a barren woman could give her maid as a wife, and the child born of that woman was regarded as the first wife's child. If the husband said to the slave wife's son, "You are my son," then he was the adopted son and heir. So it's like surrogacy today. Thus, like the practice of surrogacy practiced in our day, wherein a woman carries another woman's child and gives birth to it, Sarai's suggestion was not objectionable according to the customs of that time. However, God can and sometimes does repudiate social customs. God did not choose to do it this way, so he repudiated that social custom. Sarai's plan, with Abram's approval, turned sour, however, after the Egyptian slave girl, Hagar, became pregnant. Hagar began to despise Sarah. Both women may have wondered what would become of Abram's seed. Would Hagar have it? Because of the conflict of the women, Sarai blamed Abram for the problem. He told her to handle it in whichever way she wished. Sarai treated Hagar harshly, so Hagar fled. There is no problem seeing what went wrong on the dark side of the story. When the way of faith, which involves patient waiting, was abandoned, and the way of human wisdom was taken, Abram was caught up in a chain of causes and effects that would trouble him for many years and his descendants, because the descendants of Ishmael would be opposed to the descendants of Isaac. Okay? Okay. Let's see what time. Yeah. Okay, verses 7 to 16. 7 to 16. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. I will give to you and your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Notice, no conditions. God said further to Abram, "Now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout their generations." Now, this is the seal of the covenant. It's not what puts the covenant into effect. God's word puts it into effect. This is just a seal of the covenant. Yes. Oh, see, that's where I am. Sorry. But let me see where we should be. Yeah, I'm reading, looked at the wrong page. You're very observant. Okay, I want 7 to 16. Here we go. Now the angel of the Lord found... Yeah, I should have noticed I was reading. What was that? Okay, now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. He said, "Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going?" And she said, "I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai." Then the angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority." Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, "I will greatly multiply your descendants so they will be too many to count." The angel of the Lord said to her further, by the way, who is the angel of the Lord? The Lord, Yeshua, Jesus. "And you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael. because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. Ishmael means it cannot be counted because of how much it is, not be counted for number. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. And he will live to the east of all his brothers. Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are a God who sees." For she said, "Have I even remained alive here after seeing him?" Therefore, the well was called Beer Lahairoi. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. Okay. Now, page 69. The angel of the Lord found Hagar in the desert at a spring on the way to Shur, on the way to her homeland, Egypt. She's going to go back to Egypt. This is the first reference in the Tanakh to the angel of the Lord. This angel is identified with Adonai in 6:13 and many other passages in the Tanakh. And yet, the angel is distinct from Adonai. And that's a little confusing. The angel of the Lord is identified with Adonai. What that means is he is God. But when it says the angel is distinct from Adonai, that's Adonai the Father, who is also God. They're two distinct persons, but the fact that the same name is applied to both of them shows that they're of one essence, their unity. Thus, the angel of the Lord may refer to a theophany, that's a pre-incarnate appearance of Messiah, and that's more than likely what it is. So in the burning bush, who was speaking to Moses? Yeshua, Jesus. He is the God of the Old Testament. But again, all three persons of the Godhead take part in all of the works of God. So for example, when God destroys Sodom, it says the Lord on earth called to the Lord in heaven, and the Lord in heaven rained down fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah. So you can see two separate persons, but completely unified in their plans and in their works. After asking Hagar two questions, where have you come from and where are you going, God gave her two sure words. One was an exhortation, return and submit, verse 16. The other a promise, she would give birth to a boy. Hagar called God the one who sees me, and to commemorate the event, she named the well at that unknown location Beer Lahai Roy, well of the living one who sees me. God himself named the boy Ishmael, which he then explained, for the Lord has heard your misery. Another significant naming is Hagar's referring to God as the one who sees after her. That is, he looks out for her. So in these two names is a world of theology. God sees and God hears. And we have to remember in our lives that everything that happens in our lives, God sees it and hears it. Everything that happens to us and everything that we do. This spot would afterward become holy, a place where God could be found providing and hearing the cries of his people. Okay, next page. The names provide a message. God spoke in direct revelation and Hagar responded in faith. God sees distress and affliction and he hears. Sarai should have known this. Since God knew Sarai was barren, she should have cried out to the Lord. The same thing is true with us. When we're going through tribulation, don't trust in man or yourself. Cry out to the Lord. That doesn't mean you don't get counsel when it's necessary, but the Lord is ultimately your God. Instead, she had to learn the lesson the hard way from the experience of a despised slave wife who, ironically, came back with a faith experience. Abraham was surely rebuked when Hagar said God told her to name her son Ishmael. God hears. Because he had heard God's promise and didn't react properly to it at this point. In great distress, here Sarai's barrenness, one must turn to the Lord because he hears the afflicted, sees them in their need, and will miraculously fulfill his promises. Our deepest needs cannot be successfully resolved by human intervention. Giving children to the barren is God's work. For what is impossible with men is possible with God. Later, Leah also knew that God heard her affliction, for she named Reuben and Simeon to reflect that she still had a way to go in her faith. So God provided for the pregnant woman who was thrust out into the desert. God promised that Hagar would become a matriarch. Her son would become the father of a tribe of wild, hostile people living in the Arabian desert. But they would not be the promised seed. They would only complicate matters. Sarai's sin caused the origin of the Ishmaelites, a harvest that is still being reaped. In fact, Joseph, Sarah's grandson, was later taken to Egypt by the Ishmaelites. The lesson was clear for Sarai, Abram, Hagar, Israel, and for all believers. God's servants are to trust his word and wait for its fulfillment, enduring patiently till the end. And it has specific application to us, whether it's big or small. God is interested in the big matters of our life and the smaller matters of our life. It becomes increasingly clear in Genesis that any person or nation that owes its existence by divine election should live by faith. But the good news for God's people is that the living God sees and hears. See, the fact that God sees everything and hears everything, how do we respond to that? It depends. If you're a believer, you take great comfort in it, don't you? He sees and hears my affliction. If you're an unbeliever, you shudder at it. He sees me and he hears me in my sin. So it works both ways. All things are naked and open to him with whom we have to do. Okay, any questions? This is pretty important stuff we're going through. It carries way over into the new covenant. Give me 1 second. Let me real quickly do this.